Having to engage in a little bit of smart maintenance may leave you so bedraggled and resentful that it ends up having a negative effect on the people you are ostensibly trying to help. Researchers have found that mindfulness practice can reduce burnout among health professionals. Moreover, despite the supremely solipsistic optics of meditation, Jeff and I are of the view that the practice can both sensitize you to the challenges of others and help you respond with greater suppleness and care. It's what VMI professor Matthew Jarman argues in his Modern Warfare class, and it's what meditation masters have been arguing for millennia. The whole point of the practice is to prepare you to be of service. Jeff has personally wrestled with this issue. Self-care is my insulin, he says. If I don't take small chunks of time for myself to meditate, to be in nature, to rest, then my whole system very quickly gets out of whack. Running his meditation community in Toronto involves helping students with intense emotional challenges. This, combined with his own ADD-fueled difficulties with organization and boundaries, sometimes brought on burnout. It is the shadow side of Jeff's commitment to being of service. He sometimes pushes himself too far and gets resentful. In those times, it is not uncommon for his better half, Sarah, to direct him to the meditation cushion or push him out the door to go hug a tree. I, by contrast, have no compunction about taking care of myself. Ask anybody in my orbit, and they will tell you it's tricky to expect too much of me if I haven't gotten enough sleep, food, meditation, and exercise. I'm like a delicate ficus. Does this make me selfish or self-aware? Where do you draw the line? Whether or not you are susceptible to the meditation is self-indulgent myth, in this chapter we'll explore a few different practices that are explicitly about caring for ourselves and others. The first of these is a self-compassion meditation, which is one way of getting people to learn, in Jeff's words, how to give a shit about themselves. I will admit, it took me a while before I could bring myself to do these kinds of practices. I considered them irredeemably sappy and forced, like celebrating Valentine's Day with a knife to my throat. However, there is a growing body of science suggesting that compassion meditation can confer both health and behavioral benefits. In other words, it can make you feel better and act better. While these practices are sometimes presented in an insufferably saccharine fashion, Jeff has a unique talent for making them relatable and practical.
I have a writer pal with chronic back pain. She's a very caring and generous person, but the pain, she says, makes her selfish. When it gets bad, all her thoughts are for her own survival. The same thing can happen to people with serious emotional pain. It's me, problem solving 24/7. It's a lot harder to be there for others when you're in that state. We're not even really there for ourselves. Half the time we end up grasping at half-baked solutions or numbing or distracting ourselves with booze or work or social media so we don't have to feel our hurt or anybody else's. Support is there in the form of self-compassion. It's the most important medicine in the world that half the people in the world don't think they need. But everyone needs it sometimes because everyone goes through tough times. It can be hard to accept this. When I was younger, I'd be having a hard time, and then I'd get angry at myself that I was having a hard time in the first place. It didn't fit with my family's ideal of being stoic and uncomplaining. My life model was Sylvester Stallone from Rocky IV, whose Russian opponent remarked in an appreciative monotone, "He is like a piece of iron." Except I was more like a piece of cheap IKEA particle board, all warped and trailing sawdust. There's nothing like holding yourself to some other person's standard of engagement or fitness or happiness to make yourself well and truly miserable.
That reminds me of a famous Buddhist parable about the so-called second arrow. A man is walking through the woods and he gets hit by an arrow. He immediately engages in a round of self-pitying thoughts. Who shot me with an arrow? Why am I always the one who gets hit by an arrow? Is this going to totally ruin my dinner plans? Those painful thoughts are the second arrow.
I think many of us experience some version of this. We suffer a legitimate wound, a physical blow, a difficult emotion, a professional disappointment, and then we compound the misery with our secondary stories about how, say, we don't deserve this or how thoroughly screwed we are. We literally add insult to injury. Obviously, important learning and problem solving can happen after an injury. But other times, there's a lot of painful resistance and rumination and mechanical self-laceration. We can have really old stories, too. Some arrowhead got snapped off years before, and it's still festering in our chests, radiating out into our experience in the form of grudges and avoidances and lifelong convictions about how things are and should be. These patterns are reactions. We can live inside them without any memory or awareness of what they once reacted to. Fortunately, this compassion meditation is refreshingly direct. You don't need to figure out who or what hurt you. You can leap over all that and go straight to acknowledging that you're not feeling great in the first place. Because if you're feeling lonely or angry or overwhelmed, then, my friend, hurt is there. It's already a done deal. The other piece of good news is that this practice doesn't require feeling any specific emotion for it to work. Although, of course, feelings may happen and can be wonderfully gratifying. The definition of compassion in Buddhism is the intention that suffering be relieved. As my fellow CEC teacher and friend Abby Kramer says, an intention is not a feeling, nor is it a plan. It's more like a simple wish, in this case for someone's hurt, i.e. your own, to diminish. One of the learning curves of this practice is maintaining your intention without being attached to a particular outcome, including the outcome of feeling better, which sounds counterintuitive, but it's really important. We're not concerned with the how in this practice. We don't want to get bogged down in a new round of worrying and strategizing. The equanimity training here is genuinely wishing for our and everyone else's hurt to end, while being okay with not knowing whether it actually will end or not. This allows us to practice compassion even in cases that seem hopeless or intractable. It's a practice of caring independent of conditions. Ultimately, self-compassion is a strategy that's implemented in the moment, again and again, whenever you need it. Once you get the hang of it, it doesn't even take long. You stop for a moment, notice and accept your discomfort, big or small, and then connect to a crisp intention for that discomfort to ease. Something magical can happen in that simple acknowledgement and intention. The situation gets a little more bearable. You have more room around it, and you have more room for other people, too. You find yourself gradually expanding the range of conditions in which you see that compassion is applicable. Ready?
Only if you promise not to say the word heart.
I feel like I'm trying to sneak a love scene past the NC-17 film censor. Giving a shit about yourself. A meditation. 1 to 15 minutes. Can be done in a few moments or part of a longer practice. Start in the usual way, eyes closed or half closed, relaxing into the posture as you breathe out, straightening up the spine as you breathe in. Setting an intention here not to get too uptight about things, to go along with this experiment. Take a few breaths to get settled. Get curious about what's going on with you in this moment. Is there any way in which you aren't totally fine? Maybe there's some rushy anxiousness or a dull heartache or a feeling of stress. Or maybe there's some clear physical discomfort happening. Or maybe there's nothing like this at all. Sometimes we're just idling along in neutral. All of these states are fine. All we need to do here is sit with exactly what's happening inside us, not trying to fix anything. The beginning of compassion is allowing. Allowing ourselves to feel what we feel, to be this exact person at this exact time. Just breathing into our bodies and sitting in this accepting way with ourselves. Now for the self-compassion part. Start by connecting to a simple intention inside yourself to be well. There's nothing necessarily sentimental here. We're talking about the extremely reasonable desire to be healthy and not in pain. A short phrase here can help. May I be well. This is different, by the way, from noting or using a mantra. It's using a short phrase to highlight your intention. If that language sounds lofty or artificial, use a different one. It's okay. Or feel better. Choose words that feel natural to you. The key is to connect to your own, very sensible aspiration for your discomfort to pass. You're not trying to fix the problem or think about all its permutations. Put all that aside. You're going below it to the most simple and uncomplicated intention. Obviously, I'd prefer not to suffer. Who wouldn't? Some people recruit an image to help with this. For example, the image of themselves as a little kid. This can help kick in some nice warm feelings, although warm feelings aren't required. So you can imagine yourself as a 4-year-old running around in a park with ice cream smeared all over your face, and then you wipe out and start bawling, "Oh man, may you be well, little lady, dude, gender, non-binary kiddo." Can you connect to the reasonable feeling of wanting that kid, you, to be happy? To no longer be in pain? You can use any scenario, real or imagined, that works for you. And of course, you can use an adult version of yourself too, because that kid is still inside you, nested like a Russian doll inside your years of learning and living. May I be well. The practice is returning, again and again, to that simple intention for you to be well, and then sending that intention to yourself. You can use an image to help with the latter, or if images are tricky, you can simply focus on the embodied sense of yourself sitting. May I be well. It helps to smile. Notice what feelings might come up. All are fine and natural. Like I said earlier, the specific feelings are secondary to your intention. You may feel loving or calm. If so, great, enjoy. Or you may feel annoyed or self-conscious. Also no problem. If the latter occur, have a sense of humor about the backfiring hilarity of this meditative situation. And send that sense of humor down into your black, black heart. Compassion by another name. There's always a workaround. May I be well. Connect to the reasonableness of the intention behind your words. May I be well. For real. Like everyone else on the planet, you're doing the best you can. May I be well. May all of us be well. Recognizing our shared human condition, there can be something very poignant about this. So that's the main part of it. You're sitting there repeating your phrase, and as you do, you're continually reconnecting to that simple intention for your suffering to ease. Sending this to yourself, with maybe an extra visual or feeling. It's okay if it seems awkward at first. You're like an actor rehearsing your lines. It gets easier with time. May I be well. Eventually, your focus will be less on the words and more on the intention behind them, which gets stronger and clearer and more obviously common sense. There's one more thing you can do. If some specific part of your body actually hurts, then imagine sending your caring intention directly into that part, opening the channel, sending in healing vibes. May I be well. You're practicing giving a shit about all parts of yourself, and then feeling what you feel. Feeling and fellow feeling. May I be well. May all of us be well. A good way to finish this meditation is to expand the circle of compassion out, to imagine others in your life, others like you, people doing the best they can. Connect to your intention for them to also be well. May you be well. Find a phrase that works for you and silently repeat it if you like, maybe visualizing faces near and far. May you be well. Think of it as a final act of generosity, sending out your intention and your care and the benefits of the practice to others. Maybe there's some gratitude there. May you be well. It's basically the best training program a human being can enroll in ever. It's worth the effort. Finish up by feeling the breath and the body. Solid in your posture, supported by the ground, chilling on your stoop like a little Buddha. A final couple breaths into the chest, feeling that area fill up with warmth and air. When you're ready, open your eyes. Yes, you just did that. You are now a beautiful fruitcake of compassion. Cheat sheet. 1. Take a few breaths to get settled, and then check to see if there's any physical or emotional discomfort present. It may also be that you feel perfectly fine and normal. All possibilities are okay. 2. Connect to the simple and very reasonable intention for yourself to be well, to not be hurting. May I be well, or it's okay, or feel better. Find a phrase that works for you and repeat it, continually reestablishing that simple intention. 3. To help with this, you can draw on images and feelings, although you don't need to. It helps to smile. One image people use is themselves as a little kid. 4. Finish by sending some good vibes out to your friends and family and the whole alive planet. May you be well. Paying it forward.
My wife, Bianca, presents with an interesting variant of the meditation is self-indulgent myth. She not only resists prioritizing her own needs, but also adds to it a distinctive streak of rebelliousness. When we interviewed her at the ABC News studios back on the first day of the road trip, Jeff and I tried to get at the root of why Bianca wasn't routinely meditating. Part of it was finding the time. She said, "I'm just so busy doing things for everyone else. I'm in a caretaking profession. I have a child." Then, side-eyeing me, she said, "or two." In her job, she often has extremely busy periods at the hospital where she goes into what she described to us as intense survival mode, taking care of patients around the clock. As she told us, "The problem is there is nothing more important in those stretches. I will sacrifice whatever I have to sacrifice about myself." She made it clear, though, that she was not necessarily suffering during these times. Turning to me, she said, "It's like you covering war. My adrenaline is sky high. I'm invigorated. I'm interested. I feel good at my job, and I feel really relevant." But then she would come home from work and have to put our toddler to bed. Because of my unusual work schedule, a combination of late nights and early mornings, the job usually falls to her. This is where the aforementioned rebelliousness would kick in. Instead of meditating for a few minutes at the end of her day, which she had long acknowledged would be a smart and healing move for her, she would often make a different call. As she told us, "At 10 o'clock, when the kid is finally asleep, I would admittedly rather indulge myself in some bad TV for 10 minutes before I go to bed than anything else." Talking to Bianca, it became clear that she viewed meditation not only as self-indulgent, but also as a chore she resisted with particular ferocity because, as she had once put it, "I'm married to the happiness guru." Despite the fact that I was careful never to lecture her about meditation, merely living with me was a form of finger-wagging all its own. Even if you don't live with a semi-pro meditator, the practice, or any kind of self-care really, can be massively guilt-inducing. As Jeff says, it suggests that if you're unhappy or stressed, it's your fault for not doing anything about it. It is another form of the second arrow stuff we discussed earlier. As Jeff says, you have the original stress and now the knife you keep jabbing into yourself for not meditating. You end up in a whole aversion cycle with meditating, pushing away the thing that will help you because merely thinking about the thing that will supposedly help you, that you are of course not doing, makes you feel even worse. This is why, when he's teaching, Jeff often avoids the meditation is good for you emphasis and focuses instead on the exploratory fun of doing it for its own sake. Exercise is good for you, he says. In contrast, dancing or hiking is pleasurable in a way that creates its own motivation. When we get instrumental about meditation, we can lose touch with its intrinsic just-because goodness. Bianca's version of the second arrow was that, after sheepishly turning on the TV at the end of a long day, she often would not even allow herself the luxury of simply watching whatever show she had chosen. Rather than truly give herself some rest, she would multitask by tidying up or ordering groceries. As she told us, "I think I'm feeling better, I think I'm entertained, I think I'm more organized, but then I'm twice as spent the next day." As Bianca laid all this out for us, I knew enough to keep my mouth shut and let Jeff work his magic. He pulled what may be his most ingenious MacGyver move yet to get Bianca over the hump. He started by empathizing. He related the story of how he, too, had spent many years neglecting himself. He said, "I was helping a lot of people, and I would put all of my energy into that. But when it came to my own situation, I was constantly whatever. Now I have a practice where I'm checking in with myself," he said, looking down at himself. "I'm like, what's up, little dude? What's going on in there?" As Bianca smiled, Jeff suggested a plan for her. "I was thinking, what about a reality TV meditation? Your job every day is to watch 10 minutes of reality TV." Basically, his idea was to co-opt her current routine. He said, "You hack the existing structure of your life." As mentioned earlier, scientists who study habit formation talk about cue, behavior, reward. For Bianca, the cue had been reaching the end of her day, the behavior was to watch TV, and the reward was zoning out. Jeff's proposal was to take the same cue but slightly alter the behavior, which would transform the reward. He promised to make her a bespoke guided meditation that would combine self-care, self-compassion, and restfulness without feeling like yet another item for the to-do list. It's not another injunction, he said. Actually, it's the opposite of that. It's like being lazy in a way that's actually good for you. She seemed sold. She liked the idea of a guided meditation. She said she liked, quote, answering to someone else as opposed to myself, as long as it's not Dan. She was also enthusiastic about the fact that the practice Jeff described seemed a lot less regimented than the one I do. I will take your prescription and try it, she announced. The following is a version of the meditation Jeff made for Bianca.
This is the most over-the-top, self-indulgent meditation I can think of. It's about reveling in rest and taking care of yourself. Own it. You're allowed to do this, by the way. Call it self-care, call it basic maintenance, call it escaping from Dan's meditative gulag. Take 15 minutes to do nothing on a porch, or go for a walk, or lie on the grass. You probably already have go-tos of your own here. This meditation is about being more clear and intentional about it. Whatever you do, do not get into the trap of comparing yourself to some martyr partner slash friend slash relative. Everyone has a version of the badass Italian grandmother who raised 12 kids, had 18 grandkids, cleaned every home in the neighborhood, and made phenomenal pasta e fagioli, all while apparently never taking a break. These people make us look bad and actually are demons. The point is, everyone has different capacities, and everyone has different capacities at different times. The more rested and healthy and supported you are, the more you have to give. This obviously goes up and down depending on many internal and external variables. One of the trickier aspects of being human is balancing the amount you need to give to others with the amount you can afford to give yourself. Your body can help you make these decisions if you listen. But give yourself a break too. There are times when it's going to be unbalanced. That's just life. But we can be smart and make up for it where we can. For those who imagine this is somehow a lesser practice, I know excellent meditation teachers who only teach rest. They teach you to find it while you sit, while you lie down, even while you walk. We think we know what rest is, but many of us have no idea. Rest is on a continuum. You think you're resting, but then you realize you're actually holding your breath, holding your body tense and quivering at the edge of your meditation cushion like you have a giant pickle up your ass. And so you sigh and let go, and your whole body drops. We learn in meditation that it's possible to do this again and again and again. Each time we let go, our body seems to shed another layer of tension and gripping. They come peeling off us like ghosts, an exorcism for our secular age. Taking back lazy, or escaping Dan's meditative gulag, a meditation. 2 minutes to 2 hours. Yes, revel in it. So the first thing to do is get yourself in position. By position, I mean crash out on your back on the living room floor with the TV on in the background. Or flop down on your bed, or porch, or couch. It can be slovenly. It should be slovenly. This practice can also be done with somebody, particularly a child, a pet, or a sluggish roommate who watches too much TV and is covered in potato chip crumbs. Curl up next to them if it feels good to you. The idea is to hack whatever natural life situation you find yourself in and turn it into a perfect meditation. Close your eyes, take a few deep breaths. Make the out-breath a nice, slow, enjoyable settling. Soften the face. Slowly bring your attention to the feeling of the body lying on its back or on its side. The feeling of relaxation. Can you imagine sinking even more deeply into the ground? If you like, you can lift each arm and each leg and one by one let them flop down. As you do, really let go here, ragdoll style. Every time you think of it, imagine you can let go of another layer of tension. If there are any thoughts, just let them be in the background, like the far-off hum of a radio or television or traffic in the distance. Not a big deal. Bring your attention to any feelings of rest in your body. The simple feeling of lying there, relaxed. If there's somebody next to you, you can send your attention out and notice the physical connection with that other body. Your own body is rising and falling with the breath. The other body is rising and falling with their breath. The idea is to include this full loop of sensations, you and the other, into the meditation. Enjoying this connection and enjoying your own animal feeling. The attitude here is, yeah, all right, nothing to do. Nothing to do but rest in your own body and your own relaxed awareness. That's the main meditation instruction. If you fall asleep, then sleep. I guess you needed it. This is all about the drowsy pleasure of lying on your back on the floor with no agenda. Like when you were a kid. The innocence and simplicity of this. Relaxing, giving yourself this time, not needing anything else. In this meditation, we're emphasizing relaxation and letting go, and not trying to constantly control our situation. It doesn't matter if your mind wanders. You don't need to implement some special meditative technique, although you can if you want to. You don't even need to be mindful. Forget mindfulness. You just have to be a gorgeous, lazy slacker. In fact, let's do some more deliberate lazification here. If you feel like it, sigh and flop down a few more times, settling even more into the ground. As per the self-compassion meditation we just did, a caring peace may also emerge naturally on its own. Caring for yourself, caring for the human or animal next to you, if there is a human or animal next to you. If caring is there, let it be a pleasurable feeling in the background. Your attention is primarily on the lush laziness of the body, and maybe this other body next to you. Although you may drift too, and that's fine. That may be part of it. Notice any feelings of simple fulfillment and comfort. This is a complete practice, exactly the one you need. Taking back lazy. If you have more time, keep meditating this way. Enjoy this stolen moment. It's good for you. When you're ready to wrap up, slowly open your eyes and see if you can bring some of this relaxed vibe into the rest of your day. Oh, and tell your roommate to get a job. Cheat sheet. 1. Flop down on the floor or couch or anywhere in a relaxed and perhaps slovenly way. It's okay if a kid or animal is next to you. We'll make their presence part of the meditation. 2. Close your eyes if you like. Big relaxation on the exhale, letting go of any tension. Imagine sinking more deeply into the ground. Lift your arms and legs a bit and then flop them down a few times. Your basic attitude is, yep, nothing to do. Nothing to do but rest and drift. This is the main meditation instruction. 3. If you fall asleep, that's fine. If there are thoughts, just let them be in the background, like noise from a distant radio. Just lying on the floor in the room like when you were a kid. 4. Open your eyes when you're ready, and then slouch walk groove into the day like a young John Travolta, taken lazy to the street.
After simmering for days, our crisis of team morale came to a head in, of all places, the Big Easy. It happened, ironically, on the heels of one of the most absurdly delightful gambits of the whole trip. Jeff and I had brought along a rickety $400 meditation booth, a sort of contemplative kissing booth, which we had ordered online. We set it up on a bright, bustling morning in Jackson Square, right in the center of town. I love New Orleans, even after, perhaps especially after, having covered the horror of Hurricane Katrina. I adore everything about the place, the people, the architecture, the history, the life-altering music, and the life-shortening cuisine. Tennessee Williams is reported to have said, "There are only 3 great cities in the United States, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. All the rest are Cleveland." Ben, always looking to eke out every iota of performance from the team, went to the iconic Café du Monde and picked up containers of coffee and several bags filled with their legendary beignets, diabolical pillow-like pastries covered in powdered sugar. I had been abstaining from sweets during the road trip because they inflame my inner crackhead, disrupt my sleep, and make me generally insufferable. In what was, for me, a colossal act of self-control, I managed to limit myself to half a beignet. Wiping the powdered sugar from my face, I joined Jeff at the booth. As excited as I was about our social experiment, I was also feeling mildly anxious and self-conscious. Ever since I was a cub reporter, I had always hated MOS, man-on-the-street interviews, which entailed corralling strangers and trying to get sound bites out of them. Our booth, with its banner proclaiming free meditation lessons, was an exponentially more embarrassing version of MOS. Further down the square, there was a large crowd surrounding a guy who was performing acrobatic stunts using an enormous sparkly hula hoop. Someone with a tuba set up shop right next door to us on the promenade. "It's possible," I said to Jeff, "that we will be here for a long time and nobody will take us up on this offer." "Absolutely possible. We'll be rejected again and again," said Jeff, although he didn't seem to care. As a younger man, he had struggled with self-consciousness, but had found an unusual way of dealing with it by going to nightclubs and forcing himself to dance. It's harder to boogie when you're locked in your own head, and Jeff had developed the ability to cut loose with full-on, goofy abandon. Yet another thing I admired slash envied about him. Back at our meditation booth in Jackson Square, he noted, with something bordering on enthusiasm, "I think that we're going to find all kinds of permutations of humiliation. They're all available to us." Things began inauspiciously. A lady in a purple coat and sunglasses walked by and mentioned she had read my book. "Thanks," I said. "Want to learn how to meditate?" "No, thanks," she said, walking away. Jeff cackled. "Parenthetically," I said, "she's saying, I read your book. Not that good." Then the floodgates opened. Suddenly there were loads of people excited to meditate with us in public. Older married couples on vacation, middle-aged businessmen in town for conventions, even a local bowler hat-wearing magician who stopped by for a session before performing elsewhere on the square. Craig, a stressed-out salesman, mentioned he had recently bought my book. I thought, if this guy can relax, I can relax. Our new friends would belly up to the booth in groups of two or three at a time, where Jeff would have them rest their hands on the faux wood countertop while giving short courses in mindfulness, enveloped by the clang and clatter of the city. A funny thing happened for me as we stood there, meditating with total strangers in the middle of a noisy public space. I started to really enjoy myself. Perhaps because it was such a quote-unquote bad meditation spot by most traditional measures, I found myself just surrendering. As Jeff instructed, I let the noises flow through me, felt my feet on the ground, and tuned in, when I could, to my breath. I experienced an upwelling of gratitude toward Jeff for a virtuosic performance. Even though I make fun of him for waxing oracular at times, I know of very few other meditation teachers who could wade into such an unusual environment and truly connect with people in this way. At one point, as we were meditating with a pair of nurses who worked in a local psych ward and who used meditation as a form of self-care, Jeff suggested that they open to all the physical sensations, the sounds, and the, quote, strange self-conscious weirdness of this random situation of meditating with two middle-aged dudes in the middle of a square in New Orleans. We concluded our afternoon by meditating with Jerome, a performance artist who made his living by covering himself in silver spray paint and posing as a living statue with picture-taking tourists. He could sit with such superhuman stillness and silence that he made us meditators look like amateurs. It was awesome. However, as we packed up to leave, the beignets were gone, the booth was back in its cardboard box, and Eddie's baseline affability had fully curdled. Yet again, Ben had failed to step up and make sure we were running according to schedule, and Eddie was justifiably upset. The two of them exchanged some sharp words on the street, which produced for me the following bout of propuncha. "Eddie and Ben are going to come to blows. The tabloids are going to run stories about how this sweet, sensitive meditation road trip devolved into acrimony My mindfulness career will be comprehensively and panoramically fucked. Jazzercise. It was time to have it out. We couldn't let this fester any longer. At a truck stop about an hour out of town, I convened a meeting. Eddie, Ben, Jeff, and I commandeered the front cabin of the bus while everyone else retired to the George Clinton suite, no doubt speculating about whether there might be a homicide in the offing. As soon as the doors closed, wham, roundhouse to my head. I didn't even know who hit me. As I went down, I saw Ben throw himself up against the window. Jeff started chanting. Eddie tore open his shirt and shouted, "Who wants some of this?" Nah, the whole thing transpired in exactly the reasonable way you might expect. Eddie got a chance to vent, we listened, and we admitted we had been pushing way too hard. He teared up a bit, and we all hugged it out. Then we made a bunch of changes to the schedule, canceling some of the planned shoots so that we had more breathing room in the itinerary. We also got Ben to agree to truly take on the job of maintaining and enforcing the daily plan, ensuring that everyone was getting enough rest and food. All in all, it was one of the single quickest and most congenial instances of conflict resolution to which I had ever been a party. Afterward, we called in the rest of the gang, briefed them on the schedule changes, and did a post-mortem. Eddie was still choked up. "I felt really good about our conversation," he said. "We're meditators. There wasn't a ton of ego to smash through to get down to the kernels of the problem. There was some weird silver lining of delight in being totally ground down to revealing demons," he said. I felt like reaching out and giving the man another hug. No wonder Jeff had been so close with him for so long. There was a lot to be learned from this situation. For Eddie, it wasn't just a simple self-care lesson. It was also, he said, an allegory about what happens when mindfulness meets capitalism. It was a lesson in leadership, boundaries, and also the challenges of taking care of yourself. As we talked it through, some of our fellow travelers weighed in with their own stories about how they had put others first, failed to implement self-care, and had it all blow up in their faces. Carly Adler, who had come along to help Jeff and me turn this journey into a book, talked about one of her inner demons. As a woman who balances being a wife and a mother with a busy writing career servicing a bunch of high-octane clients, she sometimes finds herself taking on too many commitments. She said, "So it's like, yes, 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 and I mean it. It's not with resentment that I say yes and take things on. But at some point, she will encounter an unseen internal tripwire, and then," she said, "it turns into the rage fairy." Rage fairy is a term Jeff had apparently coined during a separate conversation with Carly about the issue. As Jeff explained, it's like Carly starts off as a pink fluffy unicorn who is all peace and love. But when triggered, Jeff said, she turns into this psychotic unicorn and rips the shit out of everybody. Yeah, Carly agreed as we all laughed. Unfortunately, I can be a little destructive to the people around me when willingness turns to resentment. The switch flips. And it's exactly what it feels like for me too, said Jeff. It feels literally like a switch has flipped. I guess like Jekyll and Hyde. I'm super yes, 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 happy to be helpful, and then all of a sudden my answer's like, fuck you forever. As a quick aside, I have seen this phenomenon at play with Bianca, who will have rare but piquant episodes of what the writer Gretchen Rubin calls obliger rebellion. For example, I often eat off her plate at restaurants. Usually she's happy to share, but if I have the gall to go for the last bite of her favorite orecchietti dish, I might get a fork in my eye. For Jeff, those moments often turn into opportunities for self-judgment. It's very hard to see that stuff because you think, I'm a dick and I'll always be like this. This is the real me. I was experiencing my own self-judgment during this group discussion because I couldn't really relate to much of it. I'm definitely not an accommodator the way you guys are, where I whirl around saying yes to everything. I have fears about being self-centered and about my capacity for compassion. This is a deep issue for me. For most of my life, my friends, family, and I have made a running joke out of the fact that I can be a bit of a jerk. My parents love regaling people with tales of my epic adolescence, like how I used to torture my bookish younger brother by throwing ice at the ceiling over wherever he was reading to, quote, make it snow. In college, my roommate had the habit of leaving a dictionary open on my pillow with the word ethics highlighted. In the early days of our marriage, when Bianca would confront me over some infraction, I would often smirk and proclaim it to be her fault because, quote, you married poorly. There was, unfortunately, some truth undergirding these jokes. I have a long history of being prickly. It's not that I was Genghis Khan, but there were certainly times when I escalated conflicts at work or at home into shouting matches. Part of it was congenital. I am Robert Johnson's grandson, after all. Part of it was learned. My sharp-edged sense of humor earned me friends, although admittedly not everybody was into it, and my competitive spirit propelled me forward professionally. However, even as I have outgrown much of my tendency toward being irascible, it has remained a painful part of my self-image, especially when I compare myself to softer and more effortlessly altruistic people like Bianca, Jeff, and Carly. It is not uncommon for me to notice a selfish or angry impulse arising and then launch into a whole second arrow story about what a terrible person I am. The point, as I have learned and as we have been saying throughout this book, is not to feel guilty about whatever you're feeling. It's to see it all clearly so that it doesn't control you. As Jeff explained to the group of us on the bus, the smart strategy is to work through your issues with equanimity and friendliness, which, and here's where he lost me, would clear the way for the emergence of a more loving heart. When you use terms like loving heart, can I go puke? I asked. This quickly devolved into a debate about whether we should call this book The Loving Heart by Dan Harris, featuring a gauzy picture of me on the cover with the wind blowing through my hair. Someone offered the alternative title, Awakening to Your Inner Douche by Dan Harris. Even though I am an avowed anti-sentimentalist, I really do believe in the power of compassion practices. As cloying as I may find them to be on some levels, I have been motivated to explore them precisely because I have found them to be an antidote to some of my perceived deficits. In this meditation, Jeff moves from generating compassion for ourselves to generating it for others. As we've said, you can't do the former without the latter.
Compassion makes the world go round, or at least the non-global finance parts. So it's helpful to understand the difference between feeling someone's pain on the one hand and more active compassion on the other. Social neuroscientists call the first empathic resonance. Our own bodies can literally resonate with another person's sadness or hurt or fear. Empathy is an important building block of compassion, but it can also lead to becoming overwhelmed and to what's known in the caregiver world as compassion fatigue. We end up bailing on the person in front of us because we can't handle their pain. Mature compassion, by contrast, is more sustainable. What's more, the intention and presence that it generates are arguably more helpful and comforting for the other person. How many times in our lives have we been frozen in the face of someone else's grief or loss with no idea of how to respond? Most of the time, all you need to do is shut up and show you care. Here's how. Smart compassion, a meditation. 30 seconds or more. This meditation can be done when you're alone, or it can be done on the fly, when you're actually with someone who's hurting in some way. It's always good to begin with a few long, deep inhales, just to help relax and cool out the nervous system. Right at the start, we're looking to establish an inner composure and calmness in the way we hold our experience. If you're in a sitting position, you can do this for a couple minutes, feeling the breath as your anchor, settling and breathing out any tension on the exhales as usual. If this is happening in the company of someone, these long breaths are still good to do. As you settle and get more present, you help them settle and get more present. This is part of empathic resonance. The vibes we send out and the vibes we receive are contagious. We work skillfully with this understanding. Now bring to mind the image of someone you know who needs some love. Someone who's having a hard time physically or emotionally. Maybe say their name at the start here, bringing them more fully into your experience. If you're doing this live, obviously you don't need to do this. They're right there. Notice if there are any sympathetic emotional responses in your own body and mind as you connect to their situation. That's fine. Breathe into any feelings that may be there. We'll use this as a springboard as we move to the main part of the practice. Try to connect to your sincere aspiration, your intention for this person's hurt to end. As with the self-compassion meditation, a short phrase can help. Something like, may you be well, or may you be strong. Or maybe your language is more direct. It's okay, or I'm here. Choose a sentence that works for you, and then repeat it silently. Don't spend too much time deliberating. If nothing suitable comes to mind, just use one of these. It's the intention that matters. The idea is to connect to the very reasonable desire for this person's hurt and challenge to end. We're not looking to create a particular emotional response, although emotions can happen and are welcomed. Nor are we trying to fix the person or the problem. Your compassion isn't dependent on any kind of outcome. It's caring for its own sake. We simply wish for the person to be well. It's a concentration exercise, which means continually reestablishing the intention and letting yourself feel what you feel. For the next few minutes, or for as long as makes sense if you're with the person, repeat your phrase, may you be well, at a pace that's comfortable for you. If your mind wanders, start again with your simple intention. May you be well. Patient, not in a rush. Steady expression of calm seeing and presence. I'm here. There's an understanding here that everyone goes through tough times, that life's ups and downs are beyond our control. You sit, or stand, solid inside all of this. May you be well. This is a fundamentally active practice. You're not passively submerged in feeling. Rather, you're actively offering your intention and your presence and your caring. It's a doing. We're practicing how to respond to others in a supportive way. As with every meditation in this book, it's both an exploration and a training. Stop when the time feels right. Connecting to your breath and body, feeling your feet on the ground, breathing deeply, but naturally. May you be well. May all of us be well. Cheat sheet. 1. This meditation can be done live, in front of someone who's having a hard time, or it can be done while you're sitting and imagining a person in a tough situation. Either way, take a few deep breaths to get settled. 2. Try to connect to a sincere intention for this person's hurt to end. Repeating a silent phrase in your head can help. May you be well, or it's okay, or I'm here. 3. If emotions happen, no problem. Let them be present, but they're not required. This is all about the intention, which for some people feels very reasonable and calm. 4. Repeat your phrase, may you be well, at a pace that's comfortable for you. If your mind wanders, start again with your simple intention. Not in any rush. This is all about your steady, mature presence and your compassionate intention for this person to be okay.
The day after our group reconciliation session, everyone had time for themselves. We had decided to cancel all the shoots and take a mental health day. In the morning, I bumped into Eddie in the gym at our hotel in Austin, Texas. He was jumping rope in an incredibly fluid way. As it happened, I had learned to jump rope myself a few months earlier and had all the grace of a blind howler monkey. Eddie, by contrast, seemed to be floating. Our man was back. After lunch, we all hopped back on the bus for our daily drive. With no real work to be done, I had a chance to sit back and appreciate the experience. We were just past the halfway mark of our trip, and I wanted to savor it all. The infelicities of the bus bathroom, which had really started to smell, the crazy souvenirs, a jar of spicy pickled okra was a standout, Nick, our hilarious director of photography, singing karaoke and doing eerily spot-on impersonations of George W. Bush, Dennis the sound guy wearing his perennial grin, perhaps because he was newly single and spending much of the trip using Tinder to arrange assignations in the various cities we visited, Mac Woodruff, the youngest member of our team, coincidentally the son of Bob and Lee Woodruff, who had introduced me to my wife, who, with his good looks and fashion sense, made us look cooler in public than we deserved. Our long group bull sessions, led by Jeff, who had started to remind me of the coolest camp counselor ever. The prior day's intervention, as tough as it was, had had a magical effect. The air was cleared. Newsflash, the mechanism for this kind of conflict mediation is not complicated. Talking about your emotions in a supportive environment is a time-honored tactic for working through them. Meditation is a way to provide that service for yourself, to drag your neuroses out from under their little hiding places in your mind's backwaters and expose them to the light. Of course, there are many people who do not want to do this kind of inner work. They don't want to face their emotions and deep-seated patterns. They're afraid, often justifiably. At our next stop, we would meet some people who had every reason to feel this fear. Chapter 6, Pandora's Box. It is simultaneously one of the most hilarious and appalling scientific studies I have ever seen. Researchers from the University of Virginia Department of Psychology asked subjects to sit in a lab room for 15 minutes with only their thoughts. There were no phones allowed and no other people around. However, the room was equipped with a button that the subjects could push and give themselves an electric shock if they wanted. The results were astonishing. Many of the people, including two-thirds of the men, were so uncomfortable sitting quietly alone that they opted to zap themselves. The study authors weren't quite sure what to make of this. There are many theories. You could draw the conclusion that we live in such a hyper-stimulated age that we get bored very quickly. You could also surmise, as the lead author does, that part of what is going on here is that humans evolved to scan for threats and opportunities, which can make idling excruciating. Both of these theories have merit. But I suspect, based on zero evidence beyond my layman's gut, that there could be an additional process at play. In my view, this study speaks to one of the deep and often subconscious reasons some people avoid meditation. They are afraid to be alone with how they feel. They worry that if they look inside, they will open up a Pandora's box of potentially paralytic emotions. This is a fear Jeff and I heard in a powerful way when we visited Aprendamos Intervention Team, or AIT, a company in Las Cruces, New Mexico that serves mostly low-income children with developmental disabilities and delays. The management had been trying, with mixed results, to introduce mindfulness as a form of self-care that could help the staff better handle job-related stress. Jeff and I sat down with roughly two dozen employees. Opening yourself up to vulnerability is hard. It's scary, one staff member said. Said another, some days I just don't really care for being in my own head. A physical therapist named Zoe Gutierrez said, I get people all the time asking me, how do you do what you do? You work with kids that have been abused and they have brain damage because of child abuse. How do you go into that home and deal with that parent knowing it was the dad that did it? Zoe said she loved her work, but that when it came to handling the psychological issues the job produces, her main priority was simply to move past it all. She said, I think the hard part is coming home and shutting off that side and then focusing on your family and what you have to take care of and getting back to life. We also heard from Lydia Mendez, a boisterous and likable woman who works with autistic children. At first, she told us her mind was simply too busy to meditate, a classic, I can't do this sentiment. Upon further probing, though, she admitted that despite her ebullient exterior, she suffered from anxiety and had deep reservations about sitting with herself. I'm scared of what I will find if I actually let everything out. She laughed a bit nervously, perhaps surprised by the weight of her own admission. It is true that meditating can bring up our deep fears. However, anxieties tend to surface sooner or later anyway. Meditation gives us a way to work proactively with our emotions enabling us to see them clearly rather than having them sally forth from their dank mental redoubts at a time of their choosing. There is an important caveat here. If you have trauma in your personal history, if you suffer from mental illness, or if you experience any psychological difficulties upon starting a meditation practice, it is prudent to consult a mental health professional before going any further. This does not mean that meditation isn't the right move for you, but when it comes to addressing our mental health, it's rarely one-stop shopping. That said, both Jeff and I have suffered from mild bouts of depression and/or anxiety, and we have found meditation to be enormously useful, often in conjunction with traditional psychotherapy. In my own experience, when the fog of gloom descends, meditation helps me step off the hamster wheel of obsessive thought so that I don't get so caught up in the stories barfed up by the voice in my head. In fact, research appears to back this up, suggesting that meditation can be beneficial for depression and anxiety. The Journal of the American Medical Association published a study led by the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine that found daily mindfulness-based meditation was roughly as effective as antidepressants in providing relief from some symptoms. No one is suggesting that the process of confronting your emotions through meditation is easy. In our exchange with Lydia, Jeff spoke candidly about encountering some of his own issues, in particular those created by his ADD. He said, "It was scary when I realized I had to start facing some of these things." His first few years of meditating were mostly peaceful and interesting. Then, maybe 5 years in, all this aggression and shame and hurt started to bubble up out of nowhere. It would last anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours. Even once it calmed down, I'd feel it simmering under the surface in my day-to-day life. I realized it had been there a long time. I just had never seen it clearly. Eventually, it worked itself out. Jeff also pointed out that sometimes what you're avoiding is not as bad as you might fear. He said, "Often I've had this experience. Oh, God, I don't want to go in there. And then you open the door a crack, and it's a little mouse. There's no monster in there." For many of us, the natural inclination is to run from our difficult emotions. As Stephen Colbert joked when I appeared on his show, The Colbert Report, to promote my book, "I used to not be happy all the time, and then I just grew a pair and manned up. I do what men do. We stuff it down." Meditation offers an alternative, although, as Jeff points out, it is important to pace yourself. It can be delicate work. There is a popular acronym that many people, myself included, have found useful as a guide for leaning into emotions. RAIN, R-A-I-N. Recognize, accept, investigate, non-identification. Here's Jeff.
RAIN is a way to explore any sensation, thought, or emotion, even the hard ones. It's a very useful tool to have in your meditator's tool belt. Other meditations in this book that can help with difficult emotions are Smart Compassion in Chapter 5, Taking Back Lazy in Chapter 5, and Walking Meditation in Chapter 8. The practice helps in a couple of ways. First, it boosts your emotional literacy. Instead of being lost inside an emotional reaction, you stop and get curious about what's happening inside you. Although you can obviously have emotionally loaded thoughts, our bodies are the real epicenter of our emotions. Massage therapists like to say, our issues are in our tissues. And it's true. And not just any tissues, your tissues. So you may experience anger in your jaw, or in your forearms, or in your ears as they throb and shoot cartoon flames. We're all uniquely configured, but there's also overlap. With RAIN, we get curious about our own idiosyncratic tells, the many subtle tics and quirks and contractions that are our particular body's way of saying, I'm feeling over here, feeling is happening. In this way, we can learn to catch our emotional reactions early, and not, in teacher Sharon Salzberg's excellent words, 15 consequential actions later. And there's a second way it helps. The fruit of meditation isn't just less emotional reactivity. It's also having fewer negative emotions in the first place. the more we practice observing our emotional habits, the less potent they become. Over time, they can begin to heal. This can happen even with our oldest and most private emotions. The process is slow, but it's effective. How does this happen?